This week's episode of the Dad Podcast has been brought to you by the paid subscribership of Evan, Kimberly, Christopher S., and Steve. Hello and welcome to the Dad Podcast. This is episode number 65. A ton to get into this show, but at the same time, it may also be a short one. I'm sitting here across from a confused face, I will call, on the face of my father. We're about to disembark in less than 12 hours. We're going to go on a motorcycle trip to Texas. Yes, yes?
Yes, yes.
Yes, yes. The good times will roll and will be had. But I knew I needed to get an episode out for this week while I was going to get gone, and while I was going to be gone. And I got a great interview with New York Times bestselling author Andy Andrews. So that's going to be coming up a little bit later on. But I've been trying to get to this. For those of you that also listen to Naptime Radio, you heard them talk about the infamous Tom email and how where they were when they got the Tom email. And I don't know how much detail. I can't remember how much detail they did or did not go into. But there is a listener whose name is Tom, and he sent a long email. Not long in the sense of like, oh, geesh, what's up with the homework? But an involved email. Saying, and I'll kind of paraphrase it, but it's a weird thing because, and you tell me what you think of this, Dad. It's a weird thing when somebody writes it to compliment you and then you read it on your show. Don't you think that's a little weird?
Doesn't that seem a little hard?
That seems like it's narcissistic, though. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Like it's like, oh, but here the thing about it is that I know that I like feel good stories. I like bootstrap stories, which actually comes up in the Andy Andrews later on. And I think this is a bootstrap story. And it's just coincidentally that I happen to be a pivotal part in it, I guess is the way to say it. But let's see. Here's what he says. I'm writing an email because I wanted to let you know what you have done for me in the last year. Now, this is also addressed to our fantastic friends over at Naptime Radio. Check them out at naptimeradio.com. He says, last year, actually longer, but this past year, more so. I'm writing this to you all and Justin because I'll just cut and paste most of it and then look like a fool if you ever compared notes. He says, thank you. My house was destroyed by Sandy. Before that, I was simply a struggling husband and father trying to make ends meet. I listened and laughed and connected with your podcasts, as most do, but they were an aside to the busyness of my days. After the storm, with insurance companies and mortgage companies all thinking that they knew what was best for my home, I was left with no real money to have anyone to fix the house. I was taught that the man who rolls up his sleeves will seldom lose his shirt, so that is what I did. When the money finally came through, I was so far into it and saving money on not hiring the crooks that were skulking around, so I just kept going. Now, I'm going to take a break here because, well, you weren't shiesty, but my dad spent a chunk of his life as a licensed contractor. It is not too far-fetched for a natural disaster to hit and homes are destroyed. Insurance companies are just cutting checks in large sums. And for contractors to come in and take all these shortcuts to take money from people and then blow out.
Take money. And they all show up because the cash is there. They want their section of the cash. It's easy, quick money. Everybody's in despair. They just want to get it done, get it back on track, and get on with their lives.
Yeah. So anyway, he says, and it busted my back, my balls, and my spirit quite often. An already old house with the walls exposed showed damage hidden behind walls for years. I did it all. And because my neighbors were in similar straits, I did it alone. I'd help who I could in the day and return to my house later, often late at night and into the morning. I've been from the bottom of the crawl space, waiting in crap and ancient pipes to replacing floor joists, raising the lower rooms in the house, reframing rotted walls, replacing windows and doors, installing new ceiling joists, redesigning and redoing the house on the fly, all with a deadline to back in as we were renting a summer rental for the winter. Wow. I won't be modest. Some of the stuff I pulled off shocked me. Some of the work I did is simply beautiful. Tore out walls, new floors, painted myself. The list is endless and still not done. My one constant companion, other than my allergic ancient dog, was you guys. I returned to all the old podcasts and just listened and listened. I didn't have the stomach for the other podcasts I listened to, and you all gave me the strength I didn't have without you. Being reminded of my son's need for a home and a father who could be there for him through all these scary changes was priceless. But being able to laugh with you was what got the load done. I'm not kidding here. I'm not putting too much drama into this. I was crying under my house, spraying anti-mold crap until Heather tossed off some comment that had me laughing my ass off. There were times I just sat with a tool in my hand and Justin recounting a story of yelling at his kid, "What do you want?" snapped me out of it. His telling of how he sat with his head in his hands and saying, "I didn't want this," made me get up and go again. Kate's full-on Jersey attitude and toughness made me embarrassed to feel weak at the worst moments. The banter of you two women just made it okay not to be sure if what I was doing was right, but fuck it, I'm going to go for it. I cried replacing siding with you all when you spoke of the Newtown shootings. I silently offered to beat up Dave when Heather spoke of her split. Allie's adventures, Nodelman's putting up with his abuse. The list goes on. You were with me when I remade this house. You helped me rebuild the house. I am not kidding. You were as strong a force as anything I had within me. Your silly little podcasts are a godsend. Do not forget that. What you are doing is saving people out there. Know it. You saved me. You gave me strength and helped me father on, as I say. Be really proud of what you do. I mean, be really fucking proud of what you do. I write now because I finally figured out that PayPal, I'm having a hard time reading it. PayPal check your statement crap. Yeah, that's easy when you're the only familiar with organizations. So I subscribe to both of the podcasts finally. Now, this is where I have a beef. Obviously, I'm getting choked up. I'm having a hard time reading the email because it's very sweet. But I just would like to take this opportunity to warn other listeners. Let's not let a natural disaster destroy your house before you decide to just give $2. You know what I mean? In a lot of ways, I think karma could have saved this guy, Dad. Could have saved him a lot of heartache if he would have just subscribed before Sandy.
Subscribe early. You
know, I bet you that fucking Kane takes a hook to the left and destroys
his house alone.
Yeah, destroys his dickhead neighbor and his bitchy wife with her chihuahua. She puts a sweater on. That also didn't subscribe. I mean, if you think about it, in the eastern coastline of the United States of America, there's a lot of non-subscribers.
Yes.
You know what I mean? So that's what I say. But in all seriousness, I read this because I also think it's an opportunity for me to say my side of it, to almost say in response that it is a, I don't know why I'm wired this way. I planned to do this with Natalie, but she was busy and we had to get on the road, so that's why you're here. Maybe that's because you know me as a child or you were obviously involved in making me who I am today. But I have a really hard time taking compliments, but I also know that I enjoy them.
Yes, you do.
But I know that I enjoy them because it's...
Well, what person doesn't enjoy them?
I guess you're right. But what I'm saying is that when I read this email, I was obviously touched. I wept. I'm not going to lie. I read it to my wife. She did not cry because she's more of a man than I am. But this kind of stuff is honestly why I do it. And it's very weird for me to sit here in this little room that I've built at the back end of my house. And I have fantastic, now I'm up to 31 of you fantastic people whose house will now be guaranteed never get a hit by a hurricane. That's a lock. So I make $62 a month off of this little show. But I like doing it because it was honestly purely self-serving when I started. I started it because I thought this will be something fun that will remind people of me being a stand-up. And then when I started doing research about other podcasts that were out there, and I think honestly now the genre has kind of changed, not because of me, but just because of the nature of things. But when I first started doing the show, there were no shows out there that would say, man, this fucking sucks. Like this kind of has its moments where you're just like, what the fuck? And I wanted to have an opportunity to be cathartic about it. That's what I like about my stand-up. That's what I think people laugh about when they have kids, is that it you have to find a way to laugh at this. Because when you really talk about, I was talking about, we had all of the neighbors over for dinner. And when you talk about how hard it is, there's moments where you kind of listen to like, sound kind of silly. You know what I mean? Like, it is kind of weird, but I don't know. I started asking you a question and then I started babbling, Dad, but... do you know what it is about me that I can't take a compliment that I, cause it feels weird. It feels weird to say this, but at the same time, this is why I do this. This, that's what I started to say.
Yeah, I think you've always been that way. You, even as a younger child, you weren't, you know, you did stuff. You liked the attention to some degree, but when you received that compliment, you sort of receded back. You didn't know how to respond to it. It just threw you off guard.
Even as a kid.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I don't remember that. I don't know. I just know that to this day, it's a weird thing when you do a stand-up show and people come up to you and they go, dude, that was the funniest thing I've ever seen. And I can't believe it. Like, I honestly, it feels silly just to say it here. And I wish, like, because a part of my worry, too, is that it sounds like I'm just saying it as a way of being modest. But it's the honest to God's truth, is that people have said those words to me. And if I saw them saying it to somebody else, I would be like, oh, kudos for you. But for some reason, when they say it to me, I'm like, ah, that doesn't, it's not real. It's not true. But in this case, it's pretty hard to ignore Tom and his plight. But my response to this is, I think you, Tom, should be really fucking proud of what you did and what you are doing. It takes more balls than I could ever muster, I think, to have your house destroyed. I don't know what your experience is in homework or Weekend Warriors.
I think kudos to him, because when everything was on the line, he stepped up, moved forward, and proved to everybody what a man he was.
Right.
And also proved to himself that really what type of person he was. Because he didn't, before this, he probably didn't think he was capable of hardly anything. Now he's took this on just because everything's on the line. It's for his kids. It's for his family. And he just stepped up, moved forward. Kudos to him.
Yeah, I wish that the world was made of Toms. That's my honest opinion.
We need a lot more Toms.
I mean, if you just think about it, too, those fucking kids of his, so help me God, Dad, if those fucking kids don't know how amazing their father is. Tom, let me tell you something. When your kids are of age where it's okay for me to curse at them, I will do a Skype scared straight with your children, okay? I will say, listen, you little shits. Your father rebuilt a fucking house for you so you could play your goddamn PlayStation 3, maybe 4. I don't know if you got a 4 already or pre-ordered, but goddamn it, you better knock your shit off. Because, gosh, like, it's just it's a weird thing in a world of smartphones. And I hate that this sounds so cliche, but in a world of smartphones, it's so interestingly amazing to me that a guy would do this. And that there's also a likeliness that his kids would just be like, yeah, that's what dads do. Like, whatever. So can I do Twitter in my room yet, Dad?
Can I play my PlayStation now?
And yeah, exactly. Because it really is rare. I think that it is so fucking easy just to throw your hands in the air and just wait it out, or just to walk away and try to rent another house and just let that one go.
Well, walk away and just say, this is too much. I can't take this. This is beyond my capabilities. And he didn't do that. He stepped up, moved forward, and kept trudging along until he completed it.
Right.
That's awesome.
Right. And then he gave $2 a month. Yes. I know I'm more hung up on this than I probably should. For the listeners,
Thank you, Tom.
Yeah, for the listeners who think I'm also a colossal dick, is that Tom specifically requested a ball busting, and this is the best I got. I mean, how do you bust the balls of a man who is? I mean, there's got to be, if you're a guy listening to this and go, I got that. No, Tom's dick is hanging beyond his knees. You know what I mean? Like, if you reframe a house, I feel like You know, Pinocchio tells a lie. I feel like if you rebuild a house because it was destroyed by a natural disaster and you deal with insurance companies and fraudulent contractors, you should get an extra 3 to 4 inches.
Yes.
I think it should just happen.
It should be natural.
It should be natural. In the same way that you could do push-ups and run for 45 miles to
slim
your waistline, I feel like integrity should be correlated with cock length. I feel like, and maybe that's what it is. Wonder if there's like a, what if he is like a guy who's, you know, he's swinging a good 10 to 12, you know what I mean? A third of a yard, as he probably calls it, to be modest.
Now it's 18.
And that's why he had the testosterone to go get it.
To get it done.
I couldn't even imagine. Everybody, I think, though, and this is one of the things that I learned from you, is that everybody has those types of moments. They may not be as intense as Tom's.
Well, everybody has those types of moments. And if you look back 30 years ago, that was sort of what was expected. But in today's society and stuff, it's like, hire the contractor, I'm out of here, insurance is going to pay my hotel, da-da-da-da-da-da, I don't want to deal with it. And he stepped up and he dealt with it firsthand. And probably saved a ton of money.
I know, that's my, yeah, I hope he made some money.
Take a vacation, Tom.
Yeah. God, I wish I was, seriously, if I was independently wealthy, I would buy his family a cruise. Like I would Ellen and Oprah combine him. I would double down on those two chicks. And I would go, that's a dick thing to say. Like, if I had money, I'd give it to you. Like, yeah, thanks for nothing, dickhead. Well, I gave him my podcast for free.
There you go.
And then now he pays $2 a month, as he should. So that then I can, I don't know. I know I'm trying to interject humor, but it's because I think I'm quasi uncomfortable with the emotional response that I have. But I did think the reason I brought it up, not because I think, the praise deserves me, but I really think that, more people need to hear about the stories of a guy like Tom and his situation and the bootstrap stuff. I said it in the interview you'll hear later with Andy Andrews. I love a bootstrap story. To me, it's the foundation of what America is, not to have a fucking flag.
Well, he's become a true hero to his family. I mean, it's something that his kids, everybody could look up to.
Yeah. Even if they don't, like, I don't know how old his kids are. Like, if they're 8 or something like that, they may not get it. But there'll be a time when you come out of this cocoon when you're mid-20s or something, and then when you kind of hit 30, you're like, everything just kind of goes gagoosh. Yeah. And then there's another gagoosh.
Holy shit, my dad did that.
Yeah, exactly. That's what he did. And you almost, by force, you have to live up to that. You know what I mean? Like, you don't have an option. It's like,
there goes the bar.
Yeah, you know? If your father was a colossal puss, then you're like, well, I guess I set my own bar. I don't have to worry about it. But if your dad, and I hope, here's what I want. I want Tom to be like the Paul Bunyan of our era. You know what I mean? Like, you know how there's tall tales from like hundreds of years ago? I want 300 years from now, people to hear the lore of the famous Tom. Yeah, who he traveled with a bronze hammer. Bronze is a soft metal. That was a poor choice. I wanted it like an animal to be an odd color, like Paul Bunyan's, you know, blue ox.
Blue ox.
Yeah, but I don't. What would a guy who on the East Coast? What's the East Coast known for? Leaves changing colors.
Yes, colors.
So he has a sidekick that's a tree, I guess. Maybe
follows him around changing the leaves.
And he rebuilt his house with maple syrup. He didn't have nails, and so he used maple syrup of some kind, something along those lines. So anyway, thank you, Tom. Thank you for taking the time to send your email. Thank you for pulling yourself up and making it happen. And the real kudos, I think, I hope I don't sound like a colossal douche because I really do mean it. The real kudos is for you. To be even associated with it is absolutely amazing for me. Like you made my month to the point where I was 4 weeks ahead when I got this email in episodes, and it was like eating at me that I was debating. I'm like, what if I just put in a quick thing or something like that? And I go, no, it's not a big deal. But yeah, it's a really cool thing what you did, Tom. So enough about fucking Tom. All right, that's it. Celebration over. Fuck that guy. The other thing I want to talk about, because we got a few more minutes before I want to throw to this interview with Andy Andrews, is that you and I are going on this trip and stuff, and yes. and I had this realization recently, and I wanted to know what it was, what it's like, because a lot of our listeners have older kids, but like teenagers, you know what I mean? I have very few grandparents who are interacting with their grown children. But you and I, when we talk on the phone about whatever, what I like about my relationship with my dad is that he and I will each bitch about our wives, but we do it in a way that it's
we love him.
Right. Of course. But it's just a weird thing to hear him talking about your mom, but you're like, that's right, my brother. Am I right? You know, like we don't talk jive. That's not a fair representation. But my point is, I had this realization when I was walking the dog back after one of our phone conversations that. Because I always have to say to you, I go, well, I'm the wrong person to ask because I'm a lot like you. Do you feel like you've genetically created like your own little buddy? Is that like, you know what I mean? Like you molded and raised your own, like a Dr. Frankenstein?
Pal?
Yeah, exactly. Like, I mean, clearly I'm still your son. It's not like we're, you know, but we are friendly too. But it's,
it's a unique relationship. We are friends. We are, you know, parent child, but we are friends. So, and we bounce a lot of ideas back and forth to each other.
Yeah.
And we're always seeking the other's opinion and things of that nature. I think it's just a very cool relationship.
Me too.
I had a great relationship with my father, but not to the level that we have. You know, and it's just different.
Yeah.
Very different.
So was it your intent, though? When I was born, you weren't saying, I'm going to raise this.
No, not my intent. But I think the uniqueness, you are your own man, your own person. And I think that brings out a lot of different things within our relationship together. Because you have your own opinions. We share.
Yeah, but a lot of my opinions are very similar to yours.
Well, yes. Yeah. I mean, that's why I get along with you?
Yeah, exactly.
Jeez.
That's what I'm saying. Well, like, because the other thing that made me realize it was that a friend of mine was like, he goes, you and your dad are pretty close. So I was like, I go, oh, yeah, yeah. I go, he was the best man at my wedding. Like, it was, like, but I never would have thought that you and I were different than any other father son. Like, I never thought it was extra, extra special, like, from my perspective, is what I'm saying. I guess I took it for granted, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, we are a lot alike in taste and everything else. Like, my father and I were not that much alike. And, you know, overall ideas and everything, yes. But he was a quick get it done, no aesthetics or anything to it. Just slap it together. It works. Ha ha. Great.
Moving on.
And I'm much more particular than that. And then I think you even take it another notch beyond me.
Really?
Yeah.
I would not think that.
Huh?
I would not think that.
Yeah, it's a...
You think I'm more worried about how things look than you are?
And how it goes together in the finished product.
Really?
Yeah, just a touch.
Really?
Yeah.
So this may not be interesting to the listener, but in the sense that when I found out there was all that pipe underneath the house, my desire to pull it out is something you would not have ever done.
Probably not.
Really?
And your grandfather would have never looked at it.
Unless he needed it.
Unless he
He's
needed
like, that's
to
a great storage
yeah.
space.
Might need it later.
Might need it later. It's not in my way, so that's a great place to keep it.
But yeah, little things like that did not bother him.
No.
So yeah, it's you are me kicked up, I think, another half a notch or whatever.
So then, I guess the mathematically that would mean Jacob and Jack will be kicked up another notch. Or say the other thing it does is it can overcorrect and go back the other way, right?
Could
Isn't that
be.
Also
Could
a
be, yeah? That's a possibility.
How much is it gonna suck if I hate those fucking kids? That's gonna really suck. They're going to just grow up to be dicks. It's hard to imagine that. I think everybody – don't you ever wonder that the people who have dicks, if they know their kid is a dick? I mean, you know people who've seen their kids grow up a lot more. Have you had any of your friends who have – like you guys get a couple of glasses of wine and you're like, yeah, my son's a dick. Or my daughter.
Some, but they don't see themselves as a dick. They're just looking at their kids and they don't realize that the kid is just mimicking
them.
Oh,
so you're saying they're only a dick because
they are a dick
that's
because
the example
their,
you've seen.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right.
A child is just going to react and see what's going on around him and how things are reacted to in his environment. So, I mean, you got dick parents, you got dick kids. It's just...
That's sad, though. That's
very sad.
I hope there's not some mom listening who's got a dick four-year-old.
Oh, my God.
Oh, no, I'm... it's then they now,
my
the
time
spouses,
is wasted.
We have spouses that listen to the show with each other. Like, they'll... separately, I guess, is what... but they both listen to the show, and now they're going to start blaming each other. You're the dick parent, just so you know.
That's why the kid's that way.
Just play that game.
He's following your lead.
All right. Well, yeah, I don't want to go nuts, but I was just curious. I was curious if that was ever any kind of intent.
Well, like I said, it's not an intent, but it's a specialty, and I relish this fact that this trip we're taking, mm-hmm. we're starting tomorrow, and we're going there for a purpose, but the other real portion of the trip is just you and I out on the road ourselves and yeah. sharing some of the stuff that I've done, seen, and everything else, now re-experiencing that back through you. I think it's a cool thing.
That's what I don't know. Tell me if you don't, because we can edit this. It's just a podcast. But we're going back to my grandfather's family farm, right?
Family homestead,
To spread some of his ashes. So to me, what I thought was cool about it is that it is, in a sense, three generations, and that Correct. There is aspects of everyone's interests and all combined. So it's like you and I both enjoy riding motorcycles. You know what I mean?
Well, and the thing is, he did too.
Really?
But he never got the opportunity. He always wanted to, but he never got the opportunity to do a long distance ride. So this is
the last... liked riding motorcycles?
Loved it. Yeah.
Did he ever have one?
Oh yeah, half of his life. When I was a child, 5 years old, I rode on a 650 Bonneville Triumph with him, sitting on the gas tank, and my mom was behind us, and my little brother was in between, and we'd ride all over the countryside.
Like a fucking circus family.
We'd be in jail today because that's illegal. But he had those dreams and never really got to realize them. So this is a combination of taking some of him home,
mm-hmm.
taking him on a ride that he was never, not can't say capable, but never was allowed or whatever to do. And there's one section of highway that we're going to go down by the Rio Grande River mm-hmm. that he was always fascinated. I wished I would have got more information before he passed, but I didn't. He tried to visit it 6-7 years ago and gave up. So you and I are going to take him and go down the Rio Grande and try to figure out what it was that he was so into or whatever.
It has to be some kind of Western connection, right? Isn't like every other Western?
Well, the Rio Grande was a
I feel like there's a lot of guys with leather skin and half a cigarello sticking out of their mouth going, the Rio Grande.
And the same thing, you think of Texas, you think of Rio Grande. And he was into Westerns and everything else, and Rio Grande was probably in 96% of all those old Western movies. And it was always a little fascination to him. But I guess he had quit riding motorcycles by the time that you were up and able to realize it.
Yeah, I never saw him on a motorcycle. He never talked about it. Or
probably 50. He was probably, I'm 56, so he was maybe 53 when he quit. Right, and he had a wreck.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
he dumped the bike,
and just didn't really want to get back on it again.
Huh? Was it a bad wreck or just?
No. A guy backed. Well, he was coming around a corner. A guy backed out of a driveway, and he dropped the bike. And I mean, really didn't get hurt. Didn't have to go to the hospital or anything else.
Some
but
scrapes.
it just sort of freaked him out, and he never really got back up on the bike. But he was always intent to listen and wanted me to describe the motorcycle trips and stuff that I took. He was always fascinated with that. Mm. And even, you know, because I traveled a lot in my job, he always wanted to know what highways I was on or where I was going. And
that seems like such an old guy thing. My father-in-law's like that. He's like, so would you go? And then old men always know everything more than you. Like,
yes.
They, like...
Well, why the hell did you take that highway? You should have took this one.
So when I come down, am I going to want to take, and I feel like such a fucking Generation X or whatever fucking generation I am. I don't know, guy. I just got the GPS. Yeah, I just got a GPS, and the fucking sweet British lady tells me where to go. So is there apartment buildings? So like my father always say things like, when you go like near exit 15, there's like apartment buildings. Like you just memorize freeways. And I'm like, no, I don't fucking know. There's maybe a Jack in the Box that I remember going to more than
some
once.
Some lady on the GPS tells me, yeah, turn left, turn right.
Can I tune out? I listen to podcasts.
And I show up.
Try not to hit the other cars, man. We're all going the same direction.
So, yes, this is a multifaceted trip. And ironically enough, you are now the age of what I was when I took my first cross-country motorcycle.
Oh.
So my first trip into Texas on a motorcycle, I was your age. So it's all just...
You know what my favorite part about being your son is that we do these kinds of... This is your idea, right? That you said, hey, you want to do this? I'm like, yeah, fuck it. I'm on board. Let's do it. And I like that... I like... There's a lot of situations from my childhood... and it makes me think of what my mother-in-law said, is that I yell at my kids too much. And I was telling stories about my kids and making people laugh by pretending to be rude to them and stuff. And I always stand by that because I think that it makes their childhood more interesting and thusly makes them more interesting people. That's my opinion. But I just think it's funny that when we tell people we're going to go to Texas in a week and come back, they're like, what the fuck are you doing? Why are you...
People think you're insane.
Yeah, they look at you like you're crazy, and it's kind of the fun part of it. Like, it's not like... I don't know. It's funny to me because Natalie's the same way, and Kevin, my friend, is like, anytime I just go, I drive... Like, he just says, well, the Warshims just like to drive. And it's like, well, bullshit. One Warsham likes to drive, and then 75% of us are okay sitting in the car, and then the old lady is like, fuck, I gotta get out of this car, because she never took a road trip when she was a kid. But I grew up in the stereotypical childhood. I feel like I grew up with a childhood of people that are 10 years older than me. Like, we took a trip to Texas that I vividly remember thinking it was the coolest thing in the world, that I was surrounded by suitcases and bags in the back of a station wagon.
In your own little world.
I had my own little world, and I had my Game Boy, and I go to sleep. It was like I had a room in a motorhome, but in actuality, I was 18 inches from every other person in the fucking car. I had no room in there. And yet today, like, if I go on a road trip with my kids, I have to have a phone that they can play games on. There needs to be movies and
everything.
Yeah, you have all these things that you give them, but my kids still travel pretty well, you know. But my wife, she never had any of this. And so the idea of driving somewhere, like if we go up home to visit people in Modesto, it's like a 4-hour drive from Southern California. Her thing is always like, well, I don't want to just go there and then be there a day and turn around. Like, she treats it like it's fucking London. Like, we have to adjust to the time zone. We have to decompress for a little bit before we get back in the car.
And we got
to
get ready to go home.
It's, yeah, it's been essentially what is half a work day. Like, it's not even like it's a long trip. But to get back to my point, that's part of the fun of it for me is that there's tons of stuff from my childhood that people look at you like, why would you do that? Why would you... And I don't know.
I like it for the experience.
Yeah.
I mean, I live in Central California. I've driven to Seattle for a weekend barbecue. Had the barbecue, turned around, and rode a motorcycle back home. I've driven from Billings, Montana to Reno, one ride, one day, you know. It's a challenge of that to see if you can do it. And the other thing I like about traveling... By car is cool. You get to see a lot of things. You get to experience it. By motorcycle, it's another 100 times better.
Really?
Because you can go into a gas station, fill up your car. You never say a word to anybody. If you're on a motorcycle filling up with gas, people ask you questions. Where are you going? What's going on? You know?
That's the thing I don't remember from when I had the...
It's just interaction with people. And you pull into a restaurant and park the bike, and you see this guy with these five little toddlers just drooling at your bike going, I wish the hell I could get out of here. So people are, even if they don't say, they're sort of envious of the freedom and the travel. And it's not the destination. It's a trip there.
Right.
It's what happens between the time you left and got there and come back. That's
right. Because everybody's
whole fun part to me.
When I tell people, they go, well, what are you? I go, well, the plan is I think we're supposed to be in Texas by Thursday or Friday, and then we're going to turn around and come back and probably be back Saturday. And they're like, you're just going to blow back? I said, well, yeah, we're doing all the event stuff on the way there, and then we're just going to haul ass eastbound and down.
We just make it up as we go.
Yeah, who cares? Like, Yeah, it's, and I get, this is like one of those moments that we would have on the phone for the listeners that we talk about this and then we're both realizing we're talking about the same thing. And it's, so it's not, thusly, I guess to an outside person, it's not a very interesting conversation because there aren't differing opinions. We're both explaining to each other, like, why is this interesting? Well, because we think so. Like
it's what and, makes us.
And think. Then you add to the fact that I'm your son. It's like, well, of course I'm going to think the same thing. A fucking course. Of course that's how it's going to be.
But everybody today is all get in an airplane, get there, get back.
Yeah.
And I just not that way. I like the experience of the road.
Yeah, me too.
Maybe because I did cross country trips when I was a kid, going back and forth to Texas.
It has to be.
And the
relatives. It has to be that because and your but job. Also you had so many traveling jobs.
All
too,
traveling.
I remember
all,
going
I,
with you as
yeah,
a kid,
and I enjoyed that. But my dad was a truck driver. He liked driving.
Yeah.
It was just part of what we do, and it's just that challenge of seeing if you know. I've driven back from West Texas 22 hours straight, never slept or anything, just pull over, get gas, have something to eat, and keep going down the road. Yeah, straight through. It's a challenge of seeing if you can do that. I drove back from Austin, Texas, back to your house straight through.
Yeah, I think the only way to make this better is if we could smash cut to me being 10 minutes outside of Los Angeles going, fuck, I gotta get off this bike. Holy fucking shit, I'm so, my ass hurts. That's the thing that I think is so funny, too, is that people are like, oh, your ass is going to be killing you. And I don't know. I mean, I say all this stuff because for the comedic hope of that it doesn't work out, and then I can come back and say, yeah, it was fucking sucks, but and that's what was funny about it, but... The Goldwings are so comfortable. Like, it's such an easy...
It's like riding a Lazy Boy down the freeway.
I'm going to have a hard time staying awake.
But it, all of this even goes back to when I was a kid in the mid-60s. There was a show on TV that came out, Then Came Bronson. He rode a Harley Sportster. And it shows him pulling up in San Francisco, like going out onto the Golden Gate Bridge. And there's a guy in a station wagon that pulled up beside him. Suit, tie, and all this stuff. And he goes... Where are you headed? And he turns around. He goes, wherever I end up, I guess. He goes, man, I wished I was you. And he went off to work.
That's such classic, like, 60s and 70s heavy-handed entertainment.
Yeah.
Like, everybody was a grifter that was cool. Nobody had a regular job. Like, that's
but that little thing there stuck in my mind. And that's, I think, when I really got interested in a long distance or traveling on a motorcycle.
Well, I think it'll be fun, and I'm bringing the equipment. Well, like we said, we're making it up as we go, but if we get into a hotel at night and we're like, well, that was an easy day, and we want to shoot
blow
the
it out.
We'll shoot the shit about it, then we'll maybe put piece together an episode, or maybe we'll do 80 episodes of the whole trip. I don't know.
Ooh,
so
that
I hope
would
the
be cool.
I hope the listeners enjoy. But again, to sum up before I throw to this interview with Andy Andrews, a big thank you to Tom and kudos to you. I again want to say be really fucking proud of what you did and what you continue to do. You're a good man, and all of us are lucky to have heard your story.
100% to Tom. You're riding tall in the saddle for me, Tom.
That's right. And please play this part of the episode for your wife. Here's the thing, Mrs. Tom. I need you to do something to him that will make a normal man weep with joy. Do you understand? I need you to do some kind of pelvic swirl situation. I don't know if he's a backdoor man, but if anybody deserves it, it's him. My guess is Tom is not. That's my guess. Like, I don't know. See, this is how legends are born. Like, you hear a story of a guy who rebuilt a house from a hurricane, and all of a sudden you think he doesn't believe in anal, you know, but he could be. What if they, and I'm throwing salt in his game. That's a poor choice of an analogy. But here's my point, Mrs. Tom. I'm not saying, you know, you don't need to let him hurt you. We all know what he's packing. I'm just saying you need to make sure he's handled, because the only way this story breaks bad is if all of you look at him. I'm being so rude to his wife. But all of you look at him like, yeah, that's what you're supposed to fucking do. No, I'm going to go get my nails done or whatever it is. All right, I'm going to stop talking. So here is my interview. Thanks, Dan, for being here. And I'll keep you updated on our trip. And enjoy the interview with Mr. Andy Andrews. He's got a great book. He's also got a bootstrap story. You'll hear all about it. His book is called The Notice of Returns. To give him an extra plug, you can find out about him at andyandrews.com. So, in the meantime, on behalf of my dad and myself, stay frosty, everybody. All right. I want to welcome New York Times bestselling author Andy Andrews is here, and he is here to talk to us about a new book that he has called The Noticer Returns. And what I'd like to start off, we were just chatting before we fired up the microphones, but tell me a little bit about your story, because I found out about it through reading about you and everything online, and I think it's crazy interesting.
All right. Well, yeah, and remember, you can't read everything online and be sure it's absolutely true. But I think most of it, the nice things are true.
Okay, Justin. Good. So that's a good way to look at it.
Yeah, I'm excited to be here with you. This will be fun. And my life was really kind of pretty normal until I was 19. At 19, my parents died. My mom died of cancer. My dad was killed in a car accident. So crazy time. And I've always had the ability to take a bad situation, though, and make it worse. And I did. I made some bad choices and ended up literally homeless before that was even a term. You know, 30 years ago, nobody talked about homeless people, but I you know, that wasn't a word anybody used. But I was sleeping under a pier on the Gulf Coast and in and out of people's garages. And so this is not safe or smart, but I did it. And I met this guy. I met this old guy late one night under my pier, scared me to death. And his name was Jones. We didn't call him Mr. Jones, just called him Jones. And we really never knew where he was from, didn't know how old he was. I mean, you could ask the old people in town and say, how old do you think Jones is? And they'd say, oh, I don't know. He was old when I was a kid. One of those kind of people. And very unique. Never knew what was in that suitcase he carried around, but he was really the first guy in my life ever to tell me the truth about myself. You know, I mean, which when I say that, a lot of times, you know, we meet people having a tough time, and what do? We give them $5 or we put them on the prayer list, but very rarely do we sit down with them and tell them things about themselves that might make them angry at us. And that's what this old guy did. And he called himself a noticer. He said, when God was passing out talents, I didn't get the cool ones. I can't run fast. I can't sing great. But I notice little things that make a big difference in people's life. And so this is, you know, this was really kind of the genesis of a new life for me, because he really gave me huge perspective that changed the way I think.
Yeah, and that's what I was kind of curious about, is that I've never come across, to be honest. You see people waiting outside the Lowe's with signs and things like that, and yet very rarely do I, in my experience, come across somebody who was actually homeless for a time in their life. I mean, I know that we may not have the time for the full story, but can you kind of give me in a nutshell, like, how does that happen? Do you think, here's what I guess is my real question. Do you think it's fair for people to look at people who are asking for change outside a store and saying, well, it's really on you? You know what I mean? You could have changed that for you.
Well, I really hate to say this, but to a large degree, and I'm not saying we don't help, okay? And I'm not saying we don't give change to somebody, but it really is on them.
Yeah.
And I say that. Not out of any kind of meanness. I say that knowing something that Jones taught me years ago, and that is the true meaning of responsibility. You know, we live in a society that there seems to be the greatest argument on talk radio. You know, two different sides to responsibility. One side saying, until these people accept responsibility, they'll never be able to. And, you know, the other side going, but their mother was like, you know. And
they don't have the tools. Yeah.
And so, but the idea, the truth about responsibility is, if we had a society that understood it, we would have a society that was kicking on all cylinders economically. And here's why. Responsibility doesn't have anything to do with blaming people or making people feel bad about where they are. Responsibility has everything to do with hope and control. And who in the world doesn't want to have hope for a greater future they would actually control? And yet, if you blame your mama, if you blame the president, if you blame society, if you blame your neighbor, the economy, there's not a lot of hope there, and there's zero control. Because what the heck am I going to do about the president, whoever the president happens to be? But if I can look in the mirror and I can say, you know, I've had some crazy things happen in my life, and I couldn't control any of them, But I made choices in response to those crazy things that led my life right down this path to a place I don't like. If I can understand believe that I can make choices that'll take me to a place I don't like, that's great news. Because if I can make choices that'll take me to a place I don't like, doesn't it just logically come back that you can also make choices that would take you to a place you do like? So the game becomes make better choices. And I was fortunate in that I was young enough at that time to listen to somebody.
Yeah.
And you know, a lot of times, and that you asked me, I know I'm like jabbering. And
you're fine. No, you're doing great.
Well, I know that you said, how did that happen? And I usually just talk about it like I just told you and your listeners a few minutes ago, but I'll tell you exactly how it happened. And I can tell you very quickly, my family has, if you look back at my family history, generations, there's nothing particularly horrible and there's nothing particularly great. We were a family of mild dysfunction for years and years and years, and not a single instance can I find that one generation left anything to the next generation. Not land, not money, not nothing. And so, you know, when my mom died, then my dad died. Well, when my dad died, I got $2,500. I mean, that was the insurance on my dad. And so being the financial genius that I was at that time, I took the entire $2,500 and bought a trailer. You know, it never even occurred to me that I'd have to pay to put it somewhere.
Yeah.
And so I was kind of behind the eight ball right away. But here's the quick and dirty story on how I came to live under the pier. When my dad died, pretty shortly after that, now what I'm about to tell you took 2.5-3 years, okay? I had a trailer and a car. Then I had a motorcycle and a car. Then I had a trailer and a car. Then I had a trailer and a motorcycle. Then I had a tent and a motorcycle. Then I had a tent. And when I got tired of moving that tent every 4 days in this campground that was charging me $4 or $5 a day to put it there, but they didn't want anybody living there, so they made you move it. So when I got tired of moving it and paying for it, I just like abandoned it and moved in under the pier. And that's really how it happened. You know, it's like one little thing after the other. And, you know, I didn't have any relatives at that point that, you know, and of course I had quit school. I'd quit college, and you know, when I quit college, everybody said, you know, you're ruining life. You're just gonna be a disaster. You'll be, your life is just gonna go to hell. And of course, when it actually happened, I didn't stand up and go, hey, everybody, hey, you know how you said I was? Well, I've done it, so now can you help me? I mean, I just kind of just was very quiet, and it was years and years before really anybody ever figured out what had happened during that time.
Yeah, and so this Jones, was he all like a vagabond or just like a do you know anything about his story and who he was?
You know, if you looked at him, you would think he was a vagabond.
Yeah,
he always wore the same stuff. He had on sandals, jeans, and a white T-shirt, and he had kind of longish, pure white hair, and clear blue eyes, and always smiling. But he was incredibly smart. Let me say that differently. He was incredibly wise. It was obvious he was smart, but you could talk to him a little bit, and you would begin to be amazed at the perspective that he would bring. And so, you know, Jones was a guy that really changed my thinking. I'll give you a quick example. There was one. Jones always said that perspective is more important than answers. He said, because sometimes people force answers where, you know, it's not time for an answer. Sometimes the best is a matter of timing. And he said, so sometimes people force answers where it's not time for that answer yet. And he said, they're so desperate that they'll just shove that round peg in that square hole. And you'll get something, but it won't be the best. And, of course, you start life from that point and get in the habit of shoving that square peg in the round hole or whatever, then you get farther and farther away from what the best is, and you live a life, what he called almost to almost, where you, you know, end up 50 or 60 and you go, wow, you know, it seemed like there, boy, a few years ago, didn't it seem like we were just almost financially? Yeah. Oh, wasn't our marriage at one point? I thought we were almost. Boy, the kids were just like almost, and the whole life, nothing really hits the best. And so he would say perspective brings calm. Calm leads to clear thinking. Clear thinking yields ideas. And from ideas, you get the best answers. And so one day, you know, he really shaped my thinking. I would sell bait. I caught bait, and I would sell bait. I would clean fish. I would wash boats. And one day, he kind of slipped up behind me. I was throwing a cast net, catching bait to sell to the tourist, you know. And he talked to me for a minute and said, "Hey, have you eaten?" And I said, "Well, no, you know." And he said, "Well, I got lunch. Come on, let's go." And so I put my net up and went to the top of this dune. We're looking out over the lagoon on one side, the Gulf of Mexico on the other side. And out of this sack, he pulls sardines and Vienna sausage, which, you know, sardines in one can, Vienna sausage is another can. And a couple of cans for me, a couple of cans for him. And I almost died. You know, it's like, oh my God. Could you eat anything worse?
Yeah.
And I tried not to say, and I kind of ate, and he just jabbered on. He'd talk, and so, you know, he talked about thinking, and yeah, I remember one time he said, "Hey, you can't believe everything you think," you know, because we know what we know, and we rarely think past that. And so at one point he's putting it all back. He said, "Well, let me ask you this: where are you?" And I said, "What?" He said, "Where are you right now? Where are you?" And I said, I don't understand what you're saying. He said, "Where did you eat lunch?" And I said, "On the sand." He said, "And what did you have for lunch?" And I said, "I don't understand what you're." He said, "Just answer the question. What did you have for lunch?" And I said, "Vienna sausages and sardines." He said, "Ah, I thought so." And I said, "What?" He said, "Well, we just have to work on your perspective." And I said, "Man, I am so lost here." And he said, "Well, it's pretty simple." He said, "We sat here together eating lunch." He said, "And you ate Vienna sausages and sardines in the sand." He said, "But I had surf and turf with an ocean view." I have carried that one thing with me that you would not believe how many times that I've been in situations that I can in my mind think, yep, surf and turf with an ocean view here. So
my father's perspective of that he kind of instilled in me was that he used to tell me that when you're sick, it's in your head, which sounds like a crazy person talking when you take it at face value. But as I grew older, I realized that he was essentially saying mind over matter. That if you put your mind to something, then you can make it to whatever you want it to be, and the whole point of life is to try to trick your brain into going with what you want.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
you know, I am convinced. I work with a lot of teams. I work with a lot of corporations, and I'm convinced that people cannot achieve past what they really believe. Now, I'm not saying what they throw out as a goal. I'm saying what they really believe is possible.
Yeah.
And I've seen it over and over again. I work with football teams sometimes, and I'll always get somebody up, and I've got this thing I do, and I won't go into all of it now, but I'll take this guy, and he'll face the team, and I'll have him perform this physical feat, and I'm talking, and of course the whole team knows he can do it because they've seen him do it a million times, and then I keep talking, and I change the rules on the guy. Now, he thinks something has changed, but the team is watching, and they're seeing what I'm doing behind his back, but they know that nothing has changed. The only thing that's changed is what he believes about the situation. And 60 seconds after he lifted this weight, he can't get it off the ground.
Wow.
And so it's odd. I don't really even know how that works, but I do know that it has a ton to do with what you really believe.
Mm-hmm.
And so the game, a lot of times to us, becomes how do we increase what we really believe?
Yeah. Wow, that's really cool stuff. Before I lose you, I did some digging around on your website, and because this is a show for parents and stuff like that, I had a couple questions for you. One of the things that I really liked is that you tell this great story about making memories with your kids and having your making a menu for what is just like what you kind of talked about with the sardines and Vienna sausages, is that
right?
You had some steaks and some canned green beans and canned corn, and you called them buffalo hump, I think is what it was. Is
yes,
that correct?
Yeah. Yes. Buffalo hump from a young buffalo.
Yes, that's right.
And we made up names, or I did it, you know, yeah. Because Polly said, man, I'm exhausted. I don't even know what we're having dinner tonight. I said, I got it. And so she said, are you sure? And I said, no, I got it. So I went up, looked in the cabinet. I found this like little bitty frozen beef thing. And I found a can of this and a can of that. And so then I just kind of wrote out this little menu that had all these kind of crazy things, you know, that, I forget what I even put, you know, it's like some, cream of peacock something, or, you know, it's just crazy. And I wrote it down. And as we sat down, I told the boys, I said, now, this is not what you think tonight. So before I serve you, and tonight I will serve you, Austin, would you please read the menu? And so he read it. And of course, we're all laughing. And when they see it on the plate, they see, well, that's green beans. It's corn out of a can. And it was something quick for mom, but it was a memorable night for us. You know, in this book, in this new book, The Notice of Returns, this whole story of Jones, I found him teaching a parenting class. I had not seen him in years and years and years. And I find him teaching a parenting class to two people. And, you know, it was one of those things where, okay, well, immediately my wife and I got involved in this because we want to hear everything the guy has to say. And so I detail this whole thing in this book. And it is shocking to know now what I learned from this old man about parenting. And I've got an 11-year-old and a 14-year-old, Polly and I do, and to have seen some of the things that we think we do right and some of the things that we think we understand, that Jones showed that, man, we have an amazing ability to think logically to wrong conclusions. And so some of the stuff that, and it's all detailed in this book, I think parents especially will get a huge kick out of this and a ton of information, because, you know, Jones convinced me that parenting is the fulcrum that our society tilts upon. If you, you know, I work with these coaches. I sat down with Urban Meyer the other night, and I, you know, I have my hand in the last, four BCS national championships, the last Super Bowl with the Ravens. Mm-hmm. And I am convinced that these CEOs, these coaches at the highest level, what they are doing still is extreme parenting.
Yes.
This is what they're doing. And so, you know, if you look at 70 years ago at the greatest generation, I mean, that's something that with all we disagree on today, that's something everybody agrees on, is that 70 years ago, that's the best we ever were, you know, and those people sacrificed more, they became more, and yet, when you think about it, they don't deserve the credit. The credit goes to their moms and dads and yeah. their grandparents. What standards did those parents raise those kids by across the board to create an entire generation who they took those children and an entire generation came out so well that 70 years later, we still called them the greatest. That's the best we ever were. And if you look at today and some of the challenges that we have, I think you can hang a lot of that on parenting too.
And that's kind of leads me to my last question for you is one of the things that I love the most about your story is, and it's a reoccurring theme in what you're talking about here with me today, and I think in the book too, is perspective. And I find it, I'm always a fan of a bootstrap story. I love everything about it. I think, in my opinion, it's America at its core is a bootstrap story. And that's just this idiot talking with a high school education. But I just it's inspiring, and it you can't help but look at it and feel proud of it. Like, wow, look at what that guy did. So you, literally homeless under a pier, now a New York Times best-selling author. You yourself are raising a teenager with another one coming through the pipeline. How is it that you – because I had struggles in my childhood with a paper route. Now, the generation you're talking about went through a Great Depression and things like that. These are humongous scopes of perspective that I, with my paper route, pale in comparison. How do you look at your kids and with living in what I'm assuming is a pretty nice house of an author, you know, that's doing all right for himself?
They're living better than I was when I was sleeping on the sand. I'll tell you that.
Right. And so how is it that you I find myself kind of having to rein in myself, wanting to almost force them to struggle, because I think a struggle is a good thing. But at the same time, you want them to enjoy the life that you've kind of built for them.
Justin, you just hit on something that is so huge. I work with a lot of these, you know, a lot of people, high level people that read, you know, that read the Traveler's Gift, and they read the Noticer, and you know, now hopefully they'll get the Noticer returns, and so they come to me with issues sometimes because they read the book, and I will talk to tons of parents who have huge issues with their adult children. And there's three things I can tell you right now. There's three things that will hugely help your listeners. And these came directly from Jones. And these are, you know, this is stuff that's detailed in this book, The Noticer Returns. But three things. Number one, we tend to have our eye on the wrong thing. For years and years, we hear people say, we're trying to raise great kids. You know, what are you doing? What are you doing? What's your parenting style? Man, I'm doing everything I can, doing the best I can. I'm trying to raise great kids. My job right now is I'm trying to raise great kids. That's my job. And Joan says, no, you are not. We all know parents who had great kids that turned 18 or 19, left home, and went nuts. Mm. He said, the thing you're doing, the thing you really want to do is you want to raise kids who become great adults. He said, it's a totally different process. And that leads to the second thing, which is he said, you know, King Solomon was the wisest person in the history of the world. He was the wealthiest person in the history of the world. And King Solomon said, train up a child in the way that he shall go, and when he is grown, he will not depart from it. He said, there are more sad family stories and more families mad at King Solomon because they think they did that and they didn't get the results they would like, and now they're mad about it. And he said, but see, the thing says, Solomon says, train up a child in the way that he should go, and when he is an adult, he will not depart from it. He said, King Solomon never wrote, make a kid do exactly what you want him to do, and when he is 18, he will keep doing it. It's two different things.
Yeah.
He said, this is why, because I said so, is not a good answer. He said, you can make a kid be a great kid. You can make them dress like you want them to dress. You can make them talk like you want them to talk. He said, but when they get away from you, they will do what they want to do. He said, so when we tell our teachers, he said, society's all over the teachers, and we tell teachers, hey, do not teach my kid what to think. Teach my kid how to think. He said, that's exactly right. He said, the problem with it is then the parents take the kid home and they teach him what to think, mm-hmm. which is just as dangerous as anybody else doing it. He said, because if you only teach a kid what to think, when he turns 18 or 19 and he leaves home, he's going to immediately begin to challenge and experiment and question everything he has been taught about what to think. He said, but if you teach a kid how to think, why you think like you do, that if you admit that you don't know everything and you would like to explore, but you are the final word here, but we're going to come, I'm going to tell you why I do this, and we're going to explain why. He said, then when the kid gets to be an adult, the kid will have already thought through a lot of this stuff, and there won't be a lot of things that he's questioning. You've taught him how to think. And then the last part of the third thing is, and I thought this was amazing. I saw Jones talk to a guy one time, and the guy was incredibly wealthy. And I wish I was smart enough to have thought of something like this, because I've heard this conversation a bunch of times. This guy was very, very wealthy, and he had a son who was in and out of trouble. And this son's like 25, 26, 27, something like that. And this kid is in and out of trouble, wrecks, trouble with the, with the law. I mean, it was amazing. And the dad told Jones, he said, "I've done everything that I can possibly do for this kid." And Jones said, "Okay, for a second, let's forget the kid." He said, "I want to ask you something about you." He said, "I want to know something about you. Man, I see you on television. I've read about you in the newspapers. You have made more money, and you are so highly regarded." He said, "What made you like that?" He said, "What is the most important time in your life? If you could look back into your life, what would be the moment that you say, wow, if it wasn't for that, I wouldn't be here?" Now, as an aside, Justin, for me, it's under the pier.
Mm-hmm.
I would have never chosen it in a million years. But right. If I had not spent that time under that pier, I wouldn't be talking to you. Okay, so this guy said, well, you know, it was a time I didn't know if we were going to make it. And we were living in this little apartment. I was working 20-hour days. My wife was working, and we were putting everything that we made into her business. She was pregnant. We didn't know. And he said, you know, man, it was the hardest time. He said, but we learned how to work then, and we learned how to think then, and we learned how to relate to people and how to have a smile on our face, even though we were just under huge stress. We were able to keep a smile on our face when we dealt with people, and so that they could benefit from what we were offering. He said that was the most – and Joan said, wow. He said, so the most important time to you was that struggle. He said, you know, it does seem amazing to me that as much as you love your boy, the most important time to you was that struggle, and that seems to be the one thing that you are determined not to let your boy experience.
Yeah. I couldn't agree with you more. I love everything you said, although selfishly I was kind of hoping you were planning on putting your teenager under a pier somewhere.
Hey, listen, don't think
like an Israeli army or something.
Yeah, I mean, we live 10 minutes from where that is. We live in Orange Beach, Alabama. Yeah. It was the Gulf State Park Pier. And so do not think that I haven't taken my boys down there at night and gone under there and said, all right, this is what it was like, you know?
Have Polly just allude to it. Just so, you know, you just have a little bit of hint that dad may be crazy. That's all I'm saying.
You know, like parents used to say, hey, do you want me to get the belt?
Yeah.
I mean, we
want to go to the pier?
You want to go to the pier? We'll go to the pier right now. Don't make me take you to the pier.
I will teach you to make a pillow out of sand in 5 seconds flat if you don't knock
out. Hey, you know, when I said sand a minute ago and you said sand, and it connected me with something about perspective that Joan said to me that I've always remembered. It was very quick. It was the very first night I ever met him, and I was mad. I was mean. I was not a cool person. Not.
Oh, you broke up on me a little. I don't know if you can hear me, Andy. You said not a cool person.
Sure. You know that you're right where you ought to be. And
I'm sorry. You go back? You cut out on me. You said I was not a cool person.
Okay. Yeah, I was not a cool person. I was not happy, and so I was not nice. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. I'll start that again. I heard some boo-boo like that. Anyway, yeah, I was not a cool person. I was not nice. I was not pleasant to be around. And Jones said to me that very first night, he said, look, you are actually exactly where you're supposed to be in the grand scheme of things. Mm-hmm. And of course, I wasn't having any of it. He was right. I wasn't having any of it. But the last thing he said to me, he said, boy, when you lay down tonight, you may think you're lying in sand, but trust me, you are sleeping on fertile ground. And that still gives me chills to think of that creaky old voice and those blue eyes with that sodium vapor light coming through the crack in that concrete of that pier and hearing him say that.
Yeah. Well, the name of the book is called The Noticer Returns. It's by New York Times bestselling author Andy Andrews. There's also other books. The Noticer is the first one. But it's my understanding you don't necessarily have to have read The Noticer in order to start with The Noticer Returns. So if you're a parent and you want to start with that one.
Same character, but two different books.
Right. So and after you find out you love The Noticer Returns because it's more I think what you're saying is it would be great for parents. Then you could go back and check out The Noticer, the Traveler's Gift or Guide. I'm sorry.
The Traveler's Gift.
The Traveler's Gift is another one. All of this can be found at andyandrews.com. You can get the spelling out of the description. He's on Twitter, Facebook, everything. What's a good way? Say somebody reads the book and they love it or they have a question about it. Is there a way that they can reach out to you or your folks just to kind of touch base with you?
I have a podcast, In the Loop with Andy Andrews. And as a matter of fact, as I'm sitting here talking to you, I'm thinking, wow, Justin would be a great guest on this podcast.
You're very kind.
You can subscribe, as you know, on iTunes or on my website, andyandrews.com. I'm on Facebook, find Andy Andrews, click like, I will be your friend. I'm on Twitter and do a blog. And so we're all over the place. I really, really think that your listeners will enjoy The Notice of Returns. And I want to, man, I'm going to be following you now. I've really enjoyed talking to you, Justin.
Well, thank you. Same here. I look forward to a blossoming friendship. And I also look forward in 20 years, your son's book, The Night My Dad Sent Me to the Pier.
Absolutely. I'll make sure you get an autographed copy.
Oh, I will. Trust me. I will already have one. All right. Well, thank you again for taking the time and best of luck with the book. And I have it. I'm going to read it. I love it. Thank you for being here with me today.
Thank you, buddy.
Have a good day, sir. Goodbye. All right. Well, that has been the show. Thank you again to Andy Andrews. Again, go to andyandrews.com. Don't forget, don't let a hurricane hit your house. Become a paid subscriber today. Go to thedadpodcast.com. All you have to do is click on the link. You could do $24 a year or $2 a month. And just here's the thing. I'm just going to throw it out there. What would you miss more, $2 a month or this podcast? Yeah. Yeah, I just said it. And if you'd like to give me a piece of your mind, please do so by sending an email to show@thedadpodcast.com. Or you could talk to me via Facebook at facebook.com/dadpodcast. Or follow me on the Twitter via the show at dadpodcast. Again, on behalf of Andy Andrews, my father, this is Justin Worship saying, stay frosty.